But first, science fiction novelist Neal Stephenson. He's the author of best-selling science fiction thrillers Seven Eves, Snow Crash, and Cryptonomicon. Neal's latest novel is called Fall, or Dodge in Hell. It's been described as Paradise Lost by way of Philip K. Dick.
It's an idea that's been on my mind for a little while. I've always been interested in John Milton's Paradise Lost. I kind of brushed up against that topic a little bit when I was working on the Baroque cycle, which takes place during the era that Milton was active. And I just had on my mind for a while the idea of trying to go there, except do it in a modern kind of digital science fictional kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said in an interview that your books usually start with you asking yourself the question, hey, wouldn't it be a great yarn if? Is that a question that you asked yourself when you started working on this novel?
Yeah, I think the yarn here is that someone suddenly dies and has his loved ones discover that years ago he signed an unusual last will and testament giving directions that he was supposed to be frozen and brought back to life when that became technologically possible. And it was a thing that he did kind of on a whim and forgot about it. But now it's still a binding document and they have to figure out a way to carry out his wishes. And because he's become a very wealthy individual in the meantime, they have a kind of unlimited resources with which to do that.
So can you give us kind of a Cliff's Notes-style outline of the storyline of Fall without revealing any or, at the very least, too many spoilers?
Well, I've already spoiled one thing,
yeah.
Which is that Dodge passes away pretty early in the book. It's a surprise. It's one of these unexpected medical problems that pops up out of nowhere. And so his family is left to find a way to carry out his wishes. It leads to him being brought back to life, not in a physical, biological sense, but as a digital upload into the cloud. But as so often happens with these things, it doesn't all go as planned. And so it leads to kind of the creation of a whole sort of digital afterlife that's occupied not only by the original character, Dodge, but by many other people who decide that they want to have the same treatment for themselves.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt, and you're welcome to set it up if you'd like.
Sure. This is shortly after Dodge has passed away, and the whole problem has been dumped into the lap of a friend of his named Corvallis Kawasaki, or C or C plus, or his nicknames. And he's in a conversation with a somewhat weird tech guy who gets drawn into the story named Elmo Shepard, who's obsessed with this notion of scanning people's brains and bringing them back. And so he's in the middle of a conversation with L in a bar in Seattle. Corvallis took a sip of his beer. It was good. He wondered if there was beer in L. Shepard's digital heaven. "You're probably looking at ion beam scanning," L. said. "Yes. This was the new technique Corvallis had alluded to earlier, the one Wobbsy was using on mouse brains. The family conference in the hotel suite hadn't felt like the right time or place to delve into its technical details. If you bought into the proposition, which L. Shepard apparently did, that the connectome was all there was to the human brain, that once you had created a digital record of the wiring diagram and stored that in the cloud, you could throw away what was left of the body and not lose anything that mattered, then ion beam scanning appeared to be the answer. The older technique used on the 11 Afreda cryonics brains had been to run them through what amounted to a high-precision bologna slicer, cutting away the thinnest possible layers one at a time and photographing what had been thus exposed, and then repeating the process, then trying to trace the connections as they angled across the photographic layers. This was the hard problem that Wobbsy had attempted to gamify a couple of years ago. It was only as good as the thinness of the bologna slicing, the resolution of the photographs, and the attention span of the gamers. Ion beam scanning destroyed the brain a few molecules at a time in order to save it. A beam of charged particles focused to subcellular precision burned away the brain tissue. But as it did so, it was gathering information about what it was destroying and storing it to a much higher resolution than could be attained using the older technique. In its essentials, it was the same as bologna slicing. It just worked at higher precision. Instead of a heap of paper-thin brain slices, the physical residue was smoke and steam, a higher form of cremation. Look, Corvallis said, as far as I am concerned, as a nerd who has read about it on the internet, yes, of course, way better than running it through a deli slicer and taking pictures. I would go further, Al said, and say that once we have it up and running, we are done here. Even if we did later invent a higher resolution system, it would serve no additional purpose. It would be like making a map of the United States at sub-millimeter scale, no better than a map done at centimeter scale.
You have this great ability to predict the future of technology in your fiction. The metaverse and Snow Crash is probably the best example. So I'm wondering, do you think that this idea of humans existing in the afterlife as digital souls is really something that will or could become reality?
Well, I think you're being pretty kind in your assessment of my future predicting abilities. So we could delve into that maybe at another time.
Okay.
You know, this is a case where I'm stepping back a little bit from trying to be too technically precise in the science part of it. Mm-hmm. So if you look, for example, at my previous novel, Seven Eves, in that book, I am going to some efforts to try to be sort of precise and do calculations and make it be realistic as far as the orbital mechanics and so on is concerned. But in the case of Fall, notwithstanding the bit I just read, which sounds pretty technical,
yeah,
I'm really not trying to go there because there are so many unknowns connected with how the brain works, what consciousness is, whether you could actually bring a mind back to life. So this is one of those cases where I'm just going for it. I'm just saying, let's say for the sake of storytelling that this could be done. Let's just accept that as a premise and let's see where it takes us.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of a different sort of book from your other books in the sense that it's not as technically precise because you're taking on a more ambitious and creative idea. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, it's one thing to write science fiction about the trajectory of a rocket ship, but it's a completely different domain when we start getting into, you know, what is consciousness, what does it mean to have a soul and all that. So mm-hmm. we just have to go to a more kind of relaxed and easygoing style of treating the science.
One of the big questions, and you've alluded to it already, one of the big questions that your book raises is how can we really know what is going on inside of another mind, whether it's a biological brain or a digital simulation? What do you think the answer to that is?
Well, part of what's going on there is a little bit of me trying to make a good story, right? So uh-huh. It makes for a better story if there's not a lot of direct communication between the world of the living, which we call meat space in the book,
yeah,
and bit world. Because if they're just talking to each other, then it sort of removes a lot of the potential for interest and drama in the story. So what I'm saying is that there's just such a basic disconnect between the realities that these two kinds of people live in, the physically embodied consciousness here in our world and the digital world, that they just don't have an obvious way to communicate. And the digital souls, if you want to call them that, are only dimly aware that there might be another world that they came from.
One of the things that really struck me while reading Fall is just how long your scenes go on. So many of them seem to contain clear beginnings, middles, and ends. They feel very much like real life. Is that an intentional move on your part?
I mean, my cadence of writing tends to be that I get up and I sort of have my coffee and sit down and write for a couple of hours. And so the amount of material I can write in that time is kind of maybe a natural unit of size. So that may be what you're seeing in that case.
You started out as a physics major at the University of Boston, but then you switched to geography. So I'm wondering, is there a connection between majoring in geography and just how detailed and richly textured the sense of place is in the story worlds that you build in your novels?
I believe there is. I mean, I've always been fascinated by maps and landforms and, you know, why the world is shaped and hooked up the way it is. So that's been an ongoing topic of interest to me my whole life. When I made that change during college, one of the things that sort of pushed me into it was that I was taking a cartography class, which was part of the geography department. So we were making maps, and they had a graphics terminal. It was the sort of the first computer graphics terminal I had ever had access to and been able to play around with and write code for. And so it was very primitive by today's standards, of course, but it was kind of incredible to me that I could sit and write code that would cause pictures to appear on a screen. Huh. So I've continued that interest since then, and in RIMD, when we learn about the background of Dodge's video game company and some of the people who work there, we learn about, for example, a character named Pluto, who is the landforms expert. He's kind of almost like a proxy for me in a way, the nerd who sits around and thinks about what mountains should look like. And that carries over pretty directly into Fall. Except that instead of just making a video game landscape, they end up building what amounts to a very real landscape for digital souls to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said that you tend to invent a whole different system for writing each book. Was that the case for this one, for Fall?
In the case of Fall, it's all just making stuff up. And so the amount of research was quite minimal, and it was really just me sitting down for a couple of hours every morning and telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Was that a nice change for you, not to have to do so much research and just let your imagination run wild and not have to be so tethered to reality?
I am happy either way. I actually find that being tethered, I don't think of it as being tethered to reality when I am doing a more research-based book, because reality provides all kinds of useful ideas for characters and storylines and plot events. And so it actually, I think, makes it easier to do a more research-driven book than something like this, where I'm just kind of sitting there having to pull everything out of my head.
Yeah. So did that mean because of that you were, as you say, having to sitting there pulling everything out of your head, did you have to do more revisions for Fall than you've had to for your previous novels?
A little bit, but maybe not in the way you're thinking. There's a section early on about a, I don't want to call it a prank, but it's a hoax perpetrated on the internet on an enormous scale. At the time I wrote it, which was probably 2015, early 2016, I was really patting myself on the back for being way ahead of the curve and wearing that kind of future predicting hat. And then what I and a lot of other science fiction writers found out late in 2016 was that we were way behind. We had no idea. So I had to go back in the wake of that and rethink that section a little bit and sort of recast it, not as, wow, here's an incredibly weird hypothetical thing that might happen in the future, and more as, you know, here's kind of a metaphor or a framework for thinking about what actually did happen.
I want to run one of my favorite quotes about writing by you. This is from Don DeLillo. Quote, "The sentences I am working on generate the ideas that tend to lead to more sentences," end quote. Is that the case for you?
Interesting quote. I'll say that I feel as though I do my best work when I'm writing longhand with a fountain pen. I think there's something about seeing the sentence emerge in a sort of natural cadence on the page that does lead to the next sentence and the next. And there's a really interesting thing that happens almost every day when I stop and I walk away, and then for about 15 minutes, other sentences will come into my head. And so I used to carry a little pocket tape recorder around. Now I just use a voice recorder on my phone. But I've learned to keep that handy because a lot of those phrases and sentences that pop into my head after I've stopped for the day are the ones I'm kind of most proud of.
Neal Stephenson is the author of Fall, or Dodge in Hell. You can find out more about Neal on our website, wpr.org/beta.
We ended up actually setting up a vinyl cutting lathe in India, and now, you know, we are the only people in India making records.
Ankur Malhotra tells us why he spends so much time in his homeland of India. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.